Hello, everyone, and welcome to WNPA Podcasts. This is a series of interviews where accomplished journalists share ideas about how they approach researching, interviewing, and writing stories. The hope is that you might try some of these techniques and push your journalism to a higher level. Writing stories that matter, that change the conversation, that shape the times we live in, that ultimately is our goal. And the ability to do that is what separates exceptional journalists from ordinary ones. Now here's our interviewer, Mike Dillon.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Mike Dillon, a retired community newspaper publisher and former WNPA board member. And I'm speaking from WNPA headquarters in Port Townsend. And our guest today is Spokesman Review columnist Sean Vestal. There are several reasons why I asked Sean to join us. Number one, he is an outstanding no-holds-barred columnist who started out as a beat reporter, so he knows the business. Secondly, Sean is an accomplished writer beyond the newspaper world. His novel Daredevils was published in 2016 by Penguin Press. His award-winning Godforsaken Idaho, a book of short stories, was published in 2013. And his literary nonfiction has appeared in numerous venues, including The New Yorker. And he teaches at the MFA program at Eastern Washington University, which is a program that's respected nationwide. And I also want to talk today about the Otto Zemm case in Spokane involving police misconduct. It was a case that held Spokane in thrall for years, and Sean played a strong role in trying to bring a measure of accountability and justice to one of the more egregious failures in our system. Lastly, Sean grew up in small towns in the American West, and his fiction is grounded there, and I wanted to explore how his small-town perspective has influenced his newspaper work. So that's a lot for 50 or so minutes, and let's begin, Sean. If you could just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the newspaper business and why.
Sure. So I went to the University of Idaho in the mid-80s to study to be basically an English teacher and a writer was my intention. And I needed to take some time off because I was putting myself through college. And so I took a little bit of time off in my junior year, and which ended up becoming me sort of dropping out in slow motion. And part of that was I got a job at a newspaper. When I was earning money to go back to college, I picked up a few assignments at my hometown weekly, which is the Gooding County Leader.
Okay.
It's the Gooding County Leader, and it doesn't exist anymore, I'm sorry to say, but it was the weekly in my hometown. And so they were sending me to cover the city council, which I thought was, you know, which in retrospect is funny because that's like covering the White House for the Washington Post, you know, yeah. And I had no experience. But I liked it. I kind of just took to it right away. And when they had a job, a full-time job, I took it. But that basically meant I was no longer really earning enough money to save much to go back to college. And so I kind of just over time didn't end up going back then. I did years later. But so I started working at the Northside News, which was then a weekly in Jerome, Idaho. And I was the staff, basically. I did everything. I covered the football games and the school board, and I went to the elementary school and took pictures of the poster contest award winners, and I went to court and covered crime and, you know, major lawsuits and stuff, and I took photos and pasted it up. And
What was your circulation?
Did it all.
Do you remember the?
I think it was like 2,200.
Yeah.
2,200.
Right.
Ish. You know, and it was a paper that had there was a staff, there were a couple of ad sales people, and there was an editor besides me, but for whatever reason, he just didn't do very much, didn't do any reporting and stuff. You know, and a publisher, you know, I think there were 8 or 10 people in the office.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was what at the time was a fairly standard weekly newspaper, you know, it was... a lot of community news, a lot of getting people in the paper, a lot of running into the people that you wrote about at the grocery store, you know,
right.
And about a year of that, and a job opened at a daily newspaper not too far away in Burley, Idaho. And I took that job. I was as the sports editor. And then for the next several years, I just kind of moved around to slightly bigger jobs up the food chain of community newspapers in the West.
And what were you learning during that time? And I'm thinking, you know, we keep reading so much today about how the coastal elites don't understand small town America or flyover country, however you want to call it. Yeah. What were you learning that fed into your trade and made you a better writer and journalist?
Well, I mean, I was really learning everything, I would have to say, about newspapers. I mean, I hadn't studied them. I'd only ever enrolled in one journalism class, and I dropped it. I didn't like the way the way it started out.
Right.
So I was reading, I was getting textbooks and reading them, and I was getting some guidance from the editor in terms of where to go and where things happened. But mostly I just began to attend local government meetings and see how that worked. And that in and of itself is like the idea that you go and you can ask questions and that you can demand records. All of that wasn't something I really knew. So I began to learn those things. And I began to learn that people really cared how they appeared in the paper and that you were going to run into those people, right? And that you should exercise great caution and care with their names and their reputations.
Because writing has an effect, right? You see the effects. It's a contact sport.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. And also at that time I was sort of developing this idea that really appealed to me, this idea of challenging authority, which is that just a part of my personality. And so that appeals to me. And I would watch Ted Koppel interview people at night, and I would think sometimes he would really in a professional, calm way, really kind of pin people down. So I would watch interviews like that, and I would think about how to sort of get through the way that, you know, if you're doing a kind of an accountability story where a public official is sort of waffling or weaseling or not really answering your question, that became something that I was interested in, which was sort of carrying out that role of trying to hold that public person accountable and following up with questions, not just sort of accepting what's said, putting it in the paper without thinking about it.
And did you run into any tough cases in terms of access to public records?
You know, I didn't, but I will say that in terms of seeking records, it wouldn't have been until later in my career that became something I did more regularly.
Yeah.
I think at that point, I was still learning a lot. I would not have said I had a great grasp of what you could get by requesting records, and it wasn't a part of the paper's tradition, so I didn't. So records work wasn't something I did much of until later, but I did. You know, there was a time the sheriff had upset a lot of people in his office. Not a big deal by any means. You know, I wasn't doing anything very hard hitting, I have to say, but I remember trying to ask him some questions about it and him not really wanting to talk about it and getting very upset with me. And finally saying, "All right, Sean, you're coming for my head, aren't you?" And I remember thinking, I wouldn't have thought that the sheriff cared that much. You know, I realized at the time, okay, there's a certain amount of power here and that's good. Right. But it's also something I got to be responsible with too. Like,
right.
The sheriff cares, right? The sheriff cares a lot about what I'm saying because a lot of people are going to read it and believe it. And, you know, I think some of those lessons, which seem obvious, I was really learning at a visceral firsthand.
Right. So sort of touching or getting back to my original point, what is it about small towns that you saw, and I mean, in your experience, that the larger media and on the coast or wherever don't understand what's being missed?
Well, it's a little bit hard for me to say that because that was just the world to me, right? Like I grew up in a town of about 2,000 people. And in those first few jobs, I was living in towns of a few thousand people, not too far from the town I grew up in. Right. So at Southern Idaho and small towns, that was sort of the water I swam in. And so The things that I knew about, I wasn't probably learning much about the towns themselves. As for what people in the, on the coast sort of miss about the, smaller towns. It's hard to even begin to, there's so much, you know. I mean, for one thing, the personal nature of the interrelationships and how some of the arm's length relationships that you might expect in cities between business owners and politicians, for example, or, you know, the idea that you try to avoid conflicts of interest in small towns, it's exceedingly difficult, right? Because everybody's involved, right? And there's a friendlier, I think, aspect to it. But there's also a more, I don't want to call it dishonest. That's not the word that I mean. But there's also a tendency, there's also a difficulty sometimes getting to frank and uncomfortable truths in small towns. That doesn't really relate to what people in the cities think of them. But that can be tricky. People don't like to be ruffle the waters. People don't like to make others mad or complain or criticize. And what that does is produces, I think, a kind of falseness sometimes. But
yeah.
Anyway, I might not have really spoken to your question there.
No, it does. And when you're working in a larger city, you sometimes can be more direct and expect a direct answer.
Yeah.
Is my experience. Because in a small town, I grew up in a small town. People live with things and things go unspoken and you don't stir them up. So
what I would like to hope, I don't know if this is true, but what I'd like to hope is that it helps, that having that experience helps emphasize the human part of every single story.
Yes.
I can, Spokane's not a huge city or anything, but I mean, it's conceivable that I can write about people I'll never talk to. Sometimes, if they're, for instance, involved in the criminal justice system, and we don't, and our paths don't cross, and they don't answer what I call it, whatever, it's entirely conceivable I could write something that would affect that person's reputation, make them hate me or like me, you know, and never interact with them personally. And I think that dynamic is not good for journalism. I think it's easy to be meaner than you should be as a columnist, I guess. If you're not thinking about the human person on the other end of it,
right.
You know, I've seen it in young journalists, young aggressive journalists who sometimes have a certain amount of scorn or disregard for the people that they're covering. You know, they're ambitious and careerist and they think some of the horrible things that happen to people sometimes are funny in that sort of black humor way that newsrooms have.
Right.
Harder to do that when you live in a town where you're going to see that the kid who suffered the horrible accident's father, you know, at the restaurant. You know, it's not a game, you know, you understand the consequences.
And your words have an effect.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
So, Let's move to the Otto Zem case, because you referred to your nature about questioning authority. And I'm going to read from your column, just the opening, from August 10th, 2011. I think the whole case started in 2006. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So here's your.
So I'm getting my memory of things is getting a little. I got to check things. Yeah. Oftentimes.
I think it's 2006. So your headline is "Truth About Zem Sure Took a While," and here's the opening. It took just 5 years, 20 weeks, and a day, but we're finally hearing the truth about Otto Zem from Jim Nix. In a statement filed Friday in the federal case against Officer Carl Thompson, Nix, who was the acting chief when Thompson and other officers confronted, beat, tasered, and hogtied Zem at a Zip trip on March 18th, 2006, says Thompson's account of the confrontation is factually wrong. His actions were improper, and the subsequent police investigation of the incident was insufficient. Nix, stunningly, notes that there are a lot of, quote, glaring inconsistencies, unquote, between the statements of Carl Thompson and the evidence. He didn't have much to say about the glaring inconsistencies between the statements of Jim Nix and the statements of Jim Nix. It's pretty good. I think it's sort of that's sort of classic Sean Vestal in terms of columns.
Well,
I mean, you write what, 900 plus words, and you don't tiptoe around the tulips. You're very quick out of the gate, and but yeah, you're touching base with facts. You're not bloviating. So, but can you just sort of walk us through that case, Sean? And what you learned from that, what we could learn from it.
Well, there's so much, and I think a lot of it is unique to the set of circumstances there. If there's any lesson from it, it's the same old journalism lesson, which is to be skeptical, to when things don't look right, to be wary of the official explanations. And even though I have kind of a cynical side to me, I also have this other side, which is I tend to kind of be believing of people, especially if I'm looking them in the face. And the Nix thing, and the Nix story, I will say, is more complicated. And I might add a little part to it at the end here later if I can. But it's not good to always think everybody's lying to you, but it's also not good to always believe everything that people are telling you, especially when their organization, whose reputation is at stake. And right, you should not underestimate what people will do to protect that organization and what kinds of things people will believe is right. Like, for me, one of the most disturbing things, and I haven't explained much about the case, but one of the most disturbing things was police in this town, and I think a certain number of police still in this town, feel like Carl Thompson didn't do anything wrong. And so this case is about a cop who was a mentally ill man, a mentally disabled man who worked as a janitor. He was in a Zip trip at night. There had been a report nearby of somebody harassing some girls at an ATM or something. It was kind of vague. And this cop, Carl Thompson, runs into the Zip trip. Otto Zem, the man, is holding a bottle of pop, 2-liter bottle of pop. And Thompson just begins to whack him with his baton, just repeatedly, gets him down on the ground. And he mostly just tries to get away. They come in, they hogtie him, they put a mask on him. The EMT folks come in and do that, and he ends up dying later as a result, you know, as a consequence of these actions, including this respirator that was put on him.
And Otto Zem
kind of suffocated him.
Otto Zem's last words were fairly dramatic.
I only wanted a snicker. I came in for a Snickers, or I only wanted a Snickers. Is that? I might be getting a word, or I might be putting a word or two wrong there. But he basically was saying he'd come in for a Pepsi and a Snickers. Am I getting that wrong?
No, I think you're right.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I knew those were the details of it, but word for word, I might not. Anyway, the police department, and one of the things about this, I was actually, at the time, I was working as a reporter here, and I was the night reporter that night that that happened. It's about 8:30 or 9. We're running out of time in terms of deadline, except for extraordinary things. And I just ran over there, probably more concerned about getting off and going home and having some fun than I was about covering a news story. You know, I didn't really know what had happened. There'd been some sort of an altercation. And so I went there that night, and Jim Nix came out and said that this man had lunged at the police and that they had had to use force in response to him. What happened over the course of the next several years was that was not true, was shown not to be true. The police department repeatedly came out in the early days of the investigation and asserted things that were not true, right, about Otto's aggressiveness. They did not release videotapes that were available until after they had released other kinds of videotapes. They just really played a game, in my view, a despicable game of hide the truth in order to protect a police officer who had acted in a way that when you watch that tape, it's hard not to just think that's a guy who's just lost it. That's someone who is just indulging their anger and their violence on this guy. And it didn't really match any of what had been said about it. And when Jim Nix said those things that he said, that I wrote about in the column you mentioned, that came after years of him actually being behind the scenes one of the people who pushed the department toward the truth. And when he first came out and said those things, though, he didn't really take any responsibility for being the one who had been the relayer of the bad information. But at the end of the day, in a lot of ways, Jim Nix was one of the people who was honorable in the department. And at the time that I wrote the column you quoted, I don't believe I knew that. And I wrote several other columns about Nix over the years, including one where, anyway, we kind of sat together and talked through a lot of this stuff. But Nix behind the scenes is one of the ones who did identify those problems and did begin to forced the department to readdress them. And what really brought the whole thing was when the feds got involved.
Yeah.
And they did an investigation that really brought forth a lot of facts about that. And I wrote about AutoZone a lot, and I leaned really heavily on the volumes of information that came out in the course of that investigation.
How many other voices in Spokane, I mean, in the media, were you leading the charge from the newspaper?
Well, I don't know if I was leading it. I mean, there's a reporter here, Thomas Klaus, and he was covering it, you know. He was covering it on a sort of continual basis and did a lot of great reporting on it. I was doing the more sort of analytical opinion. I was trying to weave things together in a way. There was so much to it that I was trying to find ways to be explanatory about it. And then we did have another columnist here who wrote about it a bit, or quite a bit, actually, Doug Clark. Doug writes a different kind of column than I do, and it's more of a it's more of a humor column, honestly, although this is not funny. But I mean, so he wasn't really sort of digging out new information so much as he was just sort of beating the drum on behalf of Otto in a way.
Right.
So I wouldn't say I was leading anything, but you know, I was one of the people who wrote about it a lot, for sure.
So what were the takeaways from that, Sean, in terms of what we might learn from based on your experience taking on the SPD?
Be skeptical, kind of keep an eye on the long game. Like, if somebody tells you something today and you have misgivings about it, you know, you can report it as a daily expression of what the agency said. But you can think about, well, what can I do with records here? For example, what can I begin to to request in terms of records. Who else can I talk to? Like, one of the things I didn't do the first night of the case, I didn't go talk to any witnesses. For one thing, I didn't have any idea it was as big a deal as it was. It seemed like a scuffle that sent a man to the hospital. It wasn't fatal at that time. But I didn't go in and try to interview the clerk or anything. I didn't go try to interview anybody who might have seen it. And one of the TV stations here in town did do that. And they had an interview early on where the clerk was like, they didn't think the guy had done anything wrong. And that was all. It was just a little story. I mean, it was just one little story that kind of went away until everything else started exploding. But I have often looked back on that and thought, I really kind of half-assed the first day. I really didn't foresee the issue there. And I stood outside the tape and I waited for Jim Nix to come out and tell me a lie. And I went back and I put in the paper. And it was a 3-paragraph brief. And I think about that often as a, I mean, I don't think I could have gotten to the whole truth of that story that night, but I could have found reasons to begin asking questions earlier. So
based on a few talks
and discouragingly, yeah, well, just based on had I gone around and asked anybody else, did you see anything? You know, the kind of thing you would do for any story, unless you had already filed it away in your mind as a brief, which is basically what I had done. This is a brief. I don't need to work it very hard. You know, it was laziness. It was just at the end of the day, and I was not taking it seriously. But the other thing, the discouraging thing that I've learned, and it's influenced my attitude about police culture in a big way, in a negative way. I have sometimes maybe too negative a view of the possible dangers of police culture, which is just they feel so embattled, they feel so under the gun and unappreciated and criticized unfairly that I feel like many of the officers in this department here were willing to do all sorts of things that were not honest, that might have been illegal, that that were certainly not in the community's interest in good law enforcement and transparency about the law enforcement, all to sort of protect a quote-unquote brother. And that in a force of people who carry weapons and can put you in jail and can restrict your rights, and have all this power, that can be a dangerous thing when all the cogs start clicking in that direction. And when the police officer who beat Otto Zim was finally sentenced to prison, 50 cops in this town stood up and saluted him in the courtroom in front of his victim's family. 50 cops, including our current chief of police, saluted him in a courtroom in front of the family of the man that he had, you know, like you wouldn't say he killed him, but he beat him in an incident that led to his death.
That says a lot.
You know, I'll never get, every time I see a cop car in this town, I wonder, is that one of them? Is that one of them who saw all of that and that was their response? And I have a hard time not having a real deep distrust of that organization to this day for that reason.
Yeah. Let's talk.
Anyway, I probably wandered off.
No, I mean that gene is probably a given no matter where you are, in terms of the police department, and you know, I know I have a sense of what they go through, having done a lot of police reports and looking at how they have to deal with dysfunction day in, day out, and it's not easy. On the other hand.
No. It's an incredibly hard job and an important job, and I don't hate cops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about writing. And, you know, it's always been my belief that, especially with a fragmented media culture, that the more community newspapers can do to make themselves honest brokers in the community, the better. And that can take many forms. But one way is to dig for enterprise stories that are well written, that can bring something to the reader that they are not going to get anywhere else, so that, you know, you become the indispensable medium in your market or in your hometown. One of our previous guests was Eli Sanders of The Stranger, the alternative weekly in Seattle, uh-huh. who won the Pulitzer in 2012. And I don't know if you ever read his story, The Bravest Woman in Seattle. It's magnificent. It was detailed a horrific murder, but the way he handled it was cathartic. And I mean, it couldn't have been better, and it knocked the Pulitzer judges out of their seats. And so, you know, he brought something to a terribly tragic story that you don't often see in newspapers, but newspapers are capable of delivering that kind of story. And it's important, it seems increasingly important to try. When you're in the classroom, Sean, and you're teaching writing to MFA students, and you know, who knows what they're going to go on to do. I mean, what do you talk to them about in terms of being a better writer, especially, you know, what's germane to our editors and reporters out there? One thing that I was struck by in your nonfiction, in Godforsaken Idaho, you have a sentence, quote, he smelled like the front. He's talking about a person. He smelled like the front part of a department store, glass cases and bottles, chemical suite, unquote. I mean, that takes me back, because I'm of the age where I was in department stores a lot in Seattle when I visit. And I mean, there's that dimension, that's olfactory, that you don't often see in reporting. But bringing all those elements in to make a good story, what should we bear in mind, and what can we do, and what can we do more of when we're writing our stories?
Well, I think that kind of metaphorical language is a big part of it. And it's, of course, it's a little trickier to do, and it's a little easier to do badly, I think, in journalism than it is in fiction, because you have to adhere to the truth. Although with a metaphor, you're not, you know, I mean, you're stepping outside the literal truth in a way. But I do think sensory detail and metaphorical connections are ways that you enrich storytelling. So what things looked like, smelled like, sounded like, and if you can describe those things in vivid, you know, ways, and particularly, I think, in not familiar ways, like writing, we write at the end of hundreds of years of writing, right? We're all producing language on the page after lots of language has been produced on lots of pages. And so there's a lot of form, you know, there's cliches, there's obvious cliches that we're aware of, but then there are things that aren't exactly cliches that are just kind of familiar ways of expressing things. And I think trying to find fresh and natural ways of saying things is a big part of it as well. So, I mean, I try to, and I find it all the time when I read columns that I've written, I thought, look at all the familiar phrases that I use. You know, we, especially in newspapers, we draw upon them because we're writing quickly and that's what comes into our minds. And, but I think to enrich the storytelling, we try, you know, that's one of the main things to do, sort of look at freshness of language, look at sensory detail. So be places and observe and be an observing reporter, right? Like, so, you know, especially with enterprise things where you're going to do several interviews and several different kinds of fact gathering, you know, usually there will be events that can make up, you know, quote unquote scenes in your narrative. So what you want to do is gather the information that would be scenic if you were writing it in another genre. Like, basically it's looking for trying to apply the tools of fiction writing, but you got to be rigorously factual about it. So part of that is being, when you're doing your reporting, being open to looking for and recording those kind of details when you're in places that might be scenically interesting. And part of it is, spending time with the people you're talking to face to face at a certain length where you're not asking three questions, getting the answers to those three questions, and then rushing off.
Right.
You know, where you're allowing yourself to kind of experience that moment and pay attention to the moment, to let that person talk and ramble a little bit, hopefully, if they're rambling, you know, not to be like, oh, we got to stay on, you know, to let the conversation digress a bit, and then to find the places in their story where there were sort of decision points or turning points or realizations that were made. So, and again, this is looking for material, for storytelling material that somewhat mimics fiction writing. Right?
Yes.
You're looking for the bones of a narrative, listening for the bones of a narrative. And so anyway, so all of those things requires a kind of reporting that's particular to writing a longer form. And that's, you know, at the front end, being aware of what to look for, being aware that you're looking for color, so to speak, you know, that you're looking for emotion, that you're looking for interviews with people where they get beyond the sort of surface responses and are being more self-reflective and talking about their emotions. And so all of that, oftentimes with an enterprise story, you're also doing the other stuff, right? Like the records work or, you know, just the sort of harder-nosed factual journalism.
Right.
But it's learning how to weave those things together is a challenge, you know, for sure. And it's that's what I would emphasize, I guess.
And, you know, the same applies to a city council meeting. I mean, if it's boring, somehow that can be conveyed, if not explicitly said, just in the interactions and the tones and the facial expressions and what's going on in the audience. So much of that doesn't make it to the page or to the screen. And if it's a boring meeting, may come across as a boring story. It doesn't have to be.
Right. It doesn't have to be. And sometimes you don't, you know, I mean, sometimes maybe you don't have to write a story about the meeting itself. I mean, I don't know, like that depends on where you're at and what the, you know, if you're in a small town community paper and there's a city council that you cover in your town, you probably do write about it every single time. But I would say one of the ways to look for impactful, I just said impactful. I was never going to say impactful in my life, and I just did.
Well,
anyway, impactful story, way to look for stories that have a punch, you know, a pop, is to look outside the channels that frequently get stories, to look outside of them or to look deeper into them.
Yeah.
So that means meetings, votes, press conferences, all those things. Like, they're a part of the work for sure, but they should be a starting point for further inquiry, you know, rather than the be all of the job is just sort of reflecting what happens in those things.
Right. And
I think so much of that is prepared speech, right? It's information that's been massaged for one reason or another by the time it's ready for public consumption in that way. And so, you know, I just feel like you're not really seeking the truth if all you do is that.
Yeah. Just furthering the thought about enterprise stories. And again, I've always felt, especially in a smaller community where you can take things for granted, the shock of the familiar is the kind of value-added stories that a newspaper can bring to its readers. And I looked at your February 12th column of this year. I guess it had just snowed in Spokane, and it snows a lot in Spokane. And the headline was "The Miracle and Wonderment of the Ice Crystal." And
oh yeah,
I mean, it was a wonderful column. And here's how it starts. It begins invisibly in the air above the sea. Molecules of water vapor, trillions upon trillions, escape from the ocean, rise and join water vapor from other sources to condense in tiny droplets suspended in a gray mass thousands of feet above the earth. Thus they travel from ocean to air, evolving from water to vapor to water. And the column was illustrated, too, with different kinds of ice crystals. And you tapped into the knowledge. A local expert helped you into some of the more arcane scientific facts about the story. But at one point, you write, "It is the world at its most mysterious and magical, an expression of the way nature's tiniest forms work on scales of such vastness that our minds cannot truly accommodate the wonder. We drive, we shovel, we sled, we ski, we complain, we exult, all without considering the marvel around us." I mean, that's great stuff, and it brings something to the newspaper that people might not have expected, and then would make them look around at their world again that they had taken for granted. Isn't that the point? Part of what we do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't often feel good about, about what you've written. Like, there's more opportunity to feel like, oh, I wish I'd done this or that. But I was happy with that piece, and I often think about it and try to, and ask myself, are there other ways I could be doing things that sort of are in that spirit? I do think that it's part of being a columnist is a wonderful sort of permission to step outside normal ways of responding
right.
to events. And in that case, I was honestly it was just kind of an interior monologue I was having with myself. As the snow began to fall at night at the front end of what was expected to be a long period of big, and it ended up being an incredibly long, wearisome February in terms of the snow here. But I don't know. I'm not sure at what point I started saying, but it's cool. I mean, I like snow, and I've always liked snow, and I was, being surrounded by people who were complaining about the snow. And I was just sort of watching it snow and thinking that I have always still had a kind of wonder about it. I love a first snow. I think it's beautiful, and I get tired of it too. But anyway, I don't know. I started thinking down that road, and then I had a conversation with a guy at Washington State, whose name is now escaping me, but who knows a lot about the physics of snow and ice crystals, and just decided, what if I wrote a story that was almost not conventional, in the sense that I quote the scientist describing the, but just to write it like a story, to write it like, the tale of water circling through the Earth's atmosphere, and which is exactly what it is, and which happens all the time. And anywhere you look in the world, there are such amazing forces where tiny, we know our world is made up of the tiniest elements operating in concert with each other.
Right. I mean, you obviously changed it up in this case. And I'm thinking about in other communities, I mean, it could be the story of a river or a landmark tree or a field or a family or an old building. I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And it gives writers a chance to exercise their chops.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we have just a few minutes. And I wanted to ask you, what writers, what journalists would you recommend for editors and reporters out there to learn from, past or present?
Well, I read Mike Royko when I was a kid. I don't know going back how I would feel about Royko, but I loved Royko when I was a kid. And so I had an interest in writing columns as a young kid. And I even wrote a column for my weekly newspaper when I was in eighth grade for a while. The Gooding County Leader, where I would eventually start. But so Royko had a big influence on me at the time. And I would say among the people writing today, I tend to be, lately I've been real impressed with the work that the Washington Post and the New York Times have done in terms of Trump reporting. I feel like that's a historically unique situation for the press to be in right now. And the way that, that those newspapers are handling it, I think is mostly pretty good, you know, is mostly, and in some cases has just been outstanding. Which is not to say that I don't think the places make mistakes, but I think, how do you handle and report on a president who lies all the time, who lies all the time? It breaks the norms of what we're supposed to be doing, right? Like, there's a certain amount of granting of good faith that I think is built into our norms that you have to begin to discard in a situation like that. And I think that's the right thing to do, but I think it puts journalism in a challenging position. I think it deepens some of the divides with conservatives who feel, however correctly, but who feel victimized by the media, always aggrieved by the media. So I think it's, but that doesn't really get to what you're talking about, I guess, in terms of who I admire, who I like. You know, among the columnists I like, I kind of like George Will sometimes, but I don't read him all the time. I like, and there's things he's written that I don't like at all, and I don't really agree with him, but I like that Baroque fancy style sometimes.
19th century English essay style. Yeah.
You know, I don't, if I read it three times a week, I couldn't do that, but some of his Trump columns, I think, have been outstanding.
Yeah.
I used to like Paul Krugman a lot, but, and this is what happens with columnists, is I feel like he just repeats himself.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like, you know exactly, I'm never surprised by Krugman. Let's see, who else do I like? I don't know. You know, I tend to like individual pieces more than, I no longer read a paper where there's a regular columnist that I can read, you know, cause I'm the one here basically.
Right.
There isn't a multiplicity of others. So
last question then, sort of in picking that up is how, what about building bridges, Sean, in terms of your work and editors and reporters out there who are running into the red blue divide. I mean, have you changed your approach to what you do in terms of, it used to be you would report the facts and lay them out there, and the assumption was that that was good enough. How's it changed?
Yeah. It's just become politicized to such an extreme degree. And I would say that my own responses to it have become politicized as well, in a way that they were not at all before I began writing a column. And as I think the landscape, it's very hard to imagine how to build a bridge with someone who just has a day as night difference with you on the facts and sees that difference as you being a liberal and them being a conservative. Right. And so while there certainly are differences between liberals and conservatives, the difference between, say, the science about climate change and the denial of the science about climate change, just to use a really easy example, it tends to split down liberal and conservative, but the facts of it are not. They do not divide neatly into a, well, everybody just sees things differently kind of approach.
Right.
And time and time again right now, I think we're confronted with situations like that are not, they're not symmetrical, where one side is heavily more factually correct than the other. And yet to treat them in the journalistic, with the journalistic norm of balance, would be a disservice to the truth. And to not treat them with the journalistic norm of balance makes a significant number of people feel that you're biased against them. And that deepens the dynamic in a way that is, this is not an optimistic answer I'm giving, because right now I don't feel optimistic about it. I'm almost in despair about how to correct this, because if I'm in conversations about, for example, yesterday, I was getting emails from people who were telling me, and oftentimes I just become the straw man Democrat for people to argue against. I've never written a word about President Trump's family separation policy in the spokesman. I don't think, anyway. I'm against it. I think it's awful. But those people repeatedly tell me, you know who did this first? Obama. And you never wrote about Obama. And I'm like, well, I didn't write about Trump yet either, but they're kind of arguing with me like I'm a generic lefty, you know?
Yeah.
But they're telling me things that are not true. And I'm saying, no, that's not true. And they're saying, you liberal, you know? And then all of a sudden we're in this inescapable cycle where I have expressed opinions that are left of center and do continue to express them. But and as a result of that, nothing I say is considered believable by the person that I'm having this discussion with. Now, I don't know how widespread that is. It probably seems more widespread to me since I get into the mix with people like that. But I don't know how you bridge that gap. I truly don't know how you bridge that gap. I think it's to, in a community setting, to look at all the varieties of coverage that are not political, that don't have that kind of divide, and that trying to engage people, frankly but professionally and compassionately, in disagreement is the best path.
Yes.
Having said that, that is not the path that I always take, and I wish that I did more often. But we're in a time of intense political disagreements, and having begun to write my opinions 8 years ago, I've become more opinionated, or I've become more, my opinions are more at the forefront, maybe. I don't know. I have a hard time feeling like civility isn't a kind of surrender sometimes, a civility toward falseness, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's the attitude of a zealot, right? That doesn't work. So I don't know. What I'm saying is I have feet of clay on this particular question. I need help with it as well.
Well, I think we all do. I do find myself reminding myself, because I live in a small town, that there are people I would never agree with. And yet someone returns my lost dog or helps me change my tire or
right.
perform some other act of kindness from across the divide, and the divide and those interactions doesn't exist. And you're right. I think in a community, in a small community, we look for those. It could be high school football or whatever it is, would help build some bridges anyway, and not forget that these are real human beings you're dealing with. And
I think about my family. I try to, when I'm at my best, I try to think about my family and the fact that there's some big political differences in my family, and mostly we deal with them by ignoring them.
Yes.
And if we do that, we have all this other history, background, all these other experiences. We can still be a good family and not talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
But if you don't have those underpinning connections with people that are outside of politics, and politics is where you come into contact, it's much harder, I think. And so what you're saying, that rings true to me. Like the idea of being in a community and having those connections beyond politics is where maybe there's some hope, or where you can get past it, at least in terms of daily life in a community.
Yep. Well, we'll end there, Sean. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it. And
thank you. I appreciate your interest.
Take care.
All right. You too.
Bye.
That concludes our podcast. As is always the case at WNPA, we welcome your ideas, comments, and criticisms. Our contact information can be found online at WNPA.com.